go.
There we go.
Hey, now it's recording. Hi, I'm Mark Wade.
And Ian Brill.
And you're here with 15 Minutes with Mark Wade. And what are we talking about today, Ian?
Well, we're talking about ongoing series.
I'm for them.
And indeed,
drive safely.
Right. And indeed, you know, Boom has mostly done miniseries, but Your Doomball is an ongoing. 28 Days Later is an ongoing. Die Hard. We're stepping it up. So we decided Mark's going to give us a glimpse into what's the process of an ongoing.
Die Hard's series. Ongoing. Cool. Did we announce who's going to write that yet?
I'm sure by the time that we're going to announce it's Howard Chaykin.
That's
and
awesome.
Stephen Thompson, an artist from Ireland, and Jock on covers. Cool. David Johnson on covers. John Paul Leone will do a few covers.
No, Chaykin's great. Chaykin's really good casting for that.
Yeah.
So, Irredeemable is our, you know, well, let me back up. I mean, frankly, Fall of Cthulhu was an ongoing for like
that's 14 issues.
Before. Yeah. So, it's not completely new ground for us, but we found that worked better in 4-issue chunks. Irredeemable is our first, like, really sort of out of the gate. Like, we're just going to run with this as long as we possibly can.
Yeah.
And what appealed to me about doing Irredeemable as an ongoing is that on the face of it, it seems like an idea that would be difficult to sustain for a number of years.
Yeah.
And that immediately is what made it attractive to me.
Oh.
Because the thing about the miniseries, as great as all miniseries can be, is that the moment that you know where it ends, with issue 4, issue 5, or whatever, the structure's just different. Like, not only when you're writing it, but when you're reading it, the structure's different.
Yeah.
Because you start to see where you're building to an ending. It's harder to keep the element of, well, what the hell's going to happen next when you're moving into Act 3. You know, it's...
Then you're kind of guessing, oh, I know how they're going to end this.
Yeah, I mean, exactly. I mean, every time, I know, you know, by now, because we live in such an era where everything is known ahead of time, it's, especially if you're, you know, if you're sitting down to watch, you know, a TV show and you know it's 48 minutes, you're programmed to know what's going to happen at minute 30 or minute 40 or whatever. At least it's harder to throw in surprises. So, but the appeal of an ongoing series is that idea that you can just keep stuff going and for me, it's easier to write. It's much easier to write an ongoing series because you can always just turn left abruptly if you want to, and nothing, you don't have to worry about, am I going to run out of pages? Am I going to run out of issues? The most fun I ever had writing comics was writing Flash when it was just, you know, for like 70 unbroken issues or whatever.
Yeah.
It was just like, well, I don't know what's going to happen next a lot of times, but if I'm stuck on an idea, I'm able to import some new, I'm just basically throw a spanner into the works and just see what comes of it.
Do you plan arcs?
No. Ideally, yes.
I asked that question for the listener.
I mean, ideally, in a perfect world, you do. This is another thing I was talking to students about a couple of weeks ago, which is the question of planning comes up. And while I'm a big believer in you having a destination in mind when you write, you really ought to, because if you're just flailing out blindly, it's going to kind of show in the work that you don't know where
you're going. You're not going to have a good ending when you actually do have to come to that.
Well, but you have to be prepared to completely abandon whatever you thought your ending was if a better idea comes into play. Any writer who says that he has planned out his, you know, 12-issue miniseries, every issue, every page, right down to the very last plot development and the very last line of dialogue or whatever, is either lying or a crash test dummy, because it will not go well for you then. You have that. The fun of writing and the freedom of writing and the spontaneity of writing is to be able to get in there and surprise yourself. And, you know, and I know from as a reader and as a writer, I know that if you've got stuff too planned out and too carved in stone, then there is a level of energy that is missing from the final product. Then it will kind of read a little pat. It will read a little staid and a little polite and a little dull because you as a writer are bored with it.
Yeah.
Or at least a little too familiar with it. It's that you're constantly, you know, keeping yourself on your toes like that. You constantly want it to be a juggling act where at any moment, you know, where you got your three clubs working, you know, somebody's going to throw a chainsaw in from the audience, and you got to work that into the act too. You really want.
Well, know. I was going to ask. You probably don't have to deal with this on Irredeemable, but when you're writing Flash or Fantastic Four, there's probably you want to use a character, and you're informed, oh, that character is going to die in another miniseries or something like that, and you've got to improvise. You know, there's other. Not only do you have to keep yourself on your toes, but other factors will keep you on your toes just by themselves.
Luckily, you know, I've always been lucky enough where that always works to my advantage. I mean, I don't think I wrote a single issue of the second run of Captain America. I know I didn't write a single issue of Kazar without having the villain yanked out from under me every single time.
Yeah.
This is why Kazar fought Thanos, by the way, because Kazar was never meant to fight Thanos. Because
originally it was Squirrel Girl.
It was originally, I forget who it was. It may have been Korvac. It was some. I forget who it was. It was it went through like two other iterations, where it was like the Shaper of Worlds, and then it was Korvac, and then it was like, and slowly all those characters were taken off the table as I got to my big, you know, end of first year climax, and we're kind of casting around, and then Thanos worked, and frankly, you know, Jim Starlin and I have had screaming matches about this, but I still think it works. I think what makes Kazar versus Thanos interesting to me is that it shouldn't be a fair fight. Yeah. It's like, you know, it's like, you know, Mickey Mouse versus Godzilla.
Yeah.
But, you know, I think we played fair enough with the story where Thanos is so powered down and is so, you know, it's Thanos after a bender. It's Thanos after all the Infinity Gauntlet stuff, and he's got nothing.
Yeah.
And he's rebuilding his power base. So, but you have to make those adjustments on the fly in a shared universe. Luckily, as I say, every time I've had to do it, well, Underworld's another good example. Underworld Unleashed.
Oh, that's a very famous example.
That the whole series was based around the idea that Superman was the devil's main target. And only when we got to the end of issue 2 of 3 of this big company-wide crossover was I told, oh, no, Superman's in space. So what? He's in not...
The devil can reach out to space.
The devil knows where space is. The devil knows where Neptune is. So we had to, the last possible second, we had to switch it up and make it Captain Marvel, and frankly, it made a better story. I don't mind challenge. I mean, I'm sure, like every other writer, my first instinct when I hear a stupid editorial edict like that is just to roll your eyes and go, well, great, what do we do now? But on a secret level, I sort of enjoy that challenge. I like the idea because it always pays off better and it forces me to really think. That's a big part of it. That's having to make those adjustments on the fly. And it's what I'm saying. You have to be spontaneous. You have to be, like, it's no fun to sit down and write if you think you know where it's all going to go, because the other thing I think I do pretty well in comics, I know I did it well with Impulse, is whenever I write cliffhangers, I almost always have no earthly idea.
You yourself don't know what's going to happen.
Not at all. I really honestly don't know what's going to happen next. In this, I'll set up this amazing cliffhanger, and people come to me and go, okay, well, how does he get out of it? And I'm like, I got 30 days to figure that out. I don't know.
And you don't do the cheat in, like, RKO serials.
No.
Where it's like, oh, didn't you know that they were actually inside a box?
I know. You know, last issue, Impulse was falling off a cliff. Now, having successfully not fallen off a cliff, that's... No. Well, my theory on this, and maybe it's self-justification, but my theory is that if I don't know how the cliffhanger resolves, then you can't guess.
Yeah.
And that's the magic of it. That's the best part, is if I can have, you know, if you, especially, you know, with message boards aplenty and everybody has a theory, and if message boards had existed in 1985, everyone would have known it was Ozymandias. Spoiler. Then the idea that you can surprise people is such a rarity and such a gift. So you can't do it in solicitations, because you can't even do it in the comics, because we solicit stuff 3 and 4 months ahead of time, so it's hard to write solicitations. Man, we were doing a Return of Barry Allen. I worked as hard on the solicitations for that as I did on the actual stories, because it was trying constantly to get around. Or when we came up to Flash 100, we were going to make it clear that we were trying to fake everybody out into believing that Wally wasn't going to be Flash anymore. How do we write these solicitations for issues 101, 102, 103, where we don't give away the farm, where we don't explain, you know, we don't give anything away? So that was a challenge. But don't like, just give yourself the flexibility and the freedom to find a different route to your story. I mean, on a related note, and I think I've touched upon this in podcasts before, but I'll hit them very briefly, is that there are, in this town in particular, in Hollywood in particular, in every drawer, in every desk, there is a...
People don't know, we record this podcast on Hollywood and Vine.
That's right, exactly. Live on Hollywood and Vine. Look, that's how we're waiting to be discovered. How do I recover from that one? Every drawer in every desk in this town has a half-completed screenplay, or worse, a three-quarters-completed fantasy trilogy of novels. And
there wouldn't be novels, not in this town.
Not in this town, but they're all just sitting there in drawers. And I'm firmly convinced that the reason most of the stuff is unfinished is not that people don't have ideas, it's not that people are stuck, it's not even that people are afraid of finishing. I think it's that we are conditioned to think of writing the same way we're conditioned to think about putting together IKEA furniture, in that you want to start with something and then build and build and build on top of it.
Yeah.
And to use IKEA furniture as an example, if anybody out there has ever built a piece of IKEA furniture, as well you know, the worst feeling in the world is to be two steps from the finish and realize that in step one of 87, you forgot to put that bolt in.
Yeah.
And now you've got to rip it up and start all over again. That's unfortunately, with stories, you have to do that a lot too.
Mm-hmm.
You have to be prepared to do that. And I don't think people are prepared to do that. I think people, especially more novices, are of the feeling of, well, I'm already on page 300. I must be doing something right. I don't want to, no point in breaking that up. I just got to think my way out of it. No, a lot of times, sadly, you've got to get the crowbar out and start tearing up the floorboards and get back to page 200 or get back to the last page, the last place it really worked.
Yeah.
And I think that our intrinsic fear and our hesitance to do that probably has as much to do with why these stories go unfinished as anything else. I mean, I don't want to do it either. Nobody wants to do it. Nobody wants to tear up the last day and a half worth of work because it doesn't work, but you got to be willing to do that, or else your work, again, has no spontaneity, and you'll never finish it, and it'll never be any good. You've got to be willing to give your story the freedom to move in an unexpected direction.
Mm-hmm. I mean, you said yourself in one of your the lessons that you put on the blog is that you love it when a character surprises you.
Oh, man, that's the best. It's really, they don't even have to be that beautifully well-formed a character. It's just, I just love it when a character suddenly says something in my head as I'm imagining the dialogue, or decides to turn left when you think he was going to turn right, when the plot dictates he ought to turn right. That'll lead you all kind of different directions. And on that same note, I mean, as I also said on the blog, the idea of a binary choice is sort of death in drama. Whenever you got your situation where the character can only do one of two things, then to me my instinct is always to try to find the third thing he could do that you weren't expecting, because that will lead us in some different interesting direction. And with that, I think we're about wrapped up. We're very close to 15, so we're going to hand it back off to Daphne to edit. And I am Mark Wade.
I'm Ian Brill.
And we will see you next week.
All right.